Taylor Swift, which is a dangerous subject since she wrote a song about me. Sex is the number one, orgasm, the number one experience, but a great record is number two. I started the newsletter to get another job in the music business.
Why did you have the confidence to be able to go against the grain and to be so honest in such a small industry?
You know, you're going to get me really on a rant here.
Give me the rant. In honor of my guest today, I will kick things off similar to how he kicks off his podcast. Welcome, welcome, welcome back to the Zach Kuhn Show. My guest today needs no introduction. Bob, great to have you here.
Good to be here, Zach.
Okay,
better to be on the slopes with you, but good to be here.
It's way better to be on the slopes. We could do this again from the slopes in the future. You okay. Once said, Bob, in an interview that one of your Desert Island albums is Back in Black. What do you love about that record?
The pure sound, that's the nature of metal music. Metal, well, let's start from the beginning. Once upon a time, Led Zeppelin was considered metal. Then Black Sabbath was too far out. Today, the standard is Metallica and what goes on after that. Back in Black's a little over 40 years ago that it was released at this point. And the thing about metal music, and we would have called that metal in that era, was it squeezed out all your other thoughts, and all you could do was listen to and feel the music. So that level to begin with, this is Mutt Lange's true breakthrough. Although he did sound-alike records when he lived in South Africa, he worked with City Boy, worked with Graham Parker. This was his first real breakthrough. After this, of course, Def Leppard. And just the sound of the record when you have the gong at the beginning of Hell's Bells and You Shook Me All Night Long, it is like a metal Beach Boys record. The record works on every level. I love Back in Black.
Did it feel when it came out, did it feel monumental that they switched singers and that they put a record out as good as Back in Black? Or they didn't switch singers, they got a new singer. Was that, looking back, that feels so crazy, but in the moment, did that feel monumental, or was it sort of brushed under the radar?
You have to understand, AC/DC was not that big in America. One of the legendary stories was the American label Atlantic refused to put out Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap, which they did not put out until after the success of Back in Black. So most people were not paying attention. Those of us who were, of course, the first album with It's a Long Way to the Top and the previous album with Highway to Hell, we were all stunned that the new singer sounded so similar to the old singer. Now that's de rigueur today, where bands like Journey scour the internet to find someone who sounds like the previous singer. But that was a surprise back then.
Okay, you say, you have this quote that you believe everyone wastes a decade of their life. That album came out in 1980. The Left's Its Letter was officially started in 1986. Was this the decade of your life that, I don't know, maybe you feel like was wasted? Is that your quote?
That is my quote, but that is not the decade. The 90s were the decade that I wasted.
Why was it the 90s?
My ex-wife moved out. I was broke, really broke. I could add on top of that, but that's why.
Okay, so in the 80s, you were working for Sanctuary Music.
No, I worked for Sanctuary Music a great percentage of 1984. That was it.
Got it. Okay. So I'm going to go back further. When you were in college, you took a writing course and you wrote something that you handed in and your teacher said it didn't have a twist. What did he mean by that?
Remind me how you know that.
Bob, I know everything. I've got an amazing research team over here.
Okay. You have to go back before that. When I was in high school, I wrote a couple of very successful things. When I was a freshman in college, I wrote something that was successful. So I took a writing course when I was a sophomore. This is at Middlebury College, which certainly still exists in northern Vermont. Don't forget, this is the dark ages, pre-internet, pre-DVD, pre-cable TV. I mean, if you could have cable and get the three networks, assuming you paid for that, but not on campus. So we were really pretty isolated. In any event, there was one teacher who wrote creative writing, John Claggett, who wrote see stories poorly. Whenever I, the nature of these creative writing courses is you write something and then you read them every week. And when I would read in the seminar, which was about 15 people, it would be like springtime for Hitler. And the mouths would drop, nothing would be said. I finally wrote something. It happened to be about an Alice Cooper concert, the Killer Tour at the Music Hall in Boston. And the teacher said, "That was good, but it needed a twist." I never wrote another thing for in excess of a decade because a twist at that, you're going to get me really like on a rant here. You know, these are things that I really have a problem with.
Give me the rant.
If no one changes the world by following the rules. So when it comes to writing, the peak is seen as the Iowa Writers' Workshop. If you listen to people, they will say, "Oh, writing is all about rewriting." Such that when, generally speaking, when you read the work of the product of the Iowa's Writers' Workshop, and there's some others, it's all very similar. It's very dense. There'll be all this description in sentences, whereas first and foremost, reading must be readable, just like a record. I mean, occasionally people do stuff that really has quality that takes a while for people to get into. But people have to want to listen to it. People say, "Well, what about the lyrics?" Well, if the music isn't good, it doesn't matter what the lyrics are. So in the 60s, there was new journalism. The number one practitioner was Tom Wolfe, wrote some legendary books, which were already out at that point. The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which I would tell people to read to this moment. That is nonfiction. He ultimately wrote fiction later in his life. And it was about injecting yourself in the situation and writing about your experience. It was the complete opposite of a twist. I became so disillusioned, I didn't write anything again.
Wait, but what does that mean, a twist? I don't really understand what that means.
A twist in a story. Let me come up with someone. It's a family drama. Then all of a sudden, it turns out the father has an illegitimate child. And how does that change the story? Okay. There you go to an Alice Cooper concert. Suddenly the power goes out. That would be a twist. Something unforeseen, which would then change the narrative.
And this one teacher who said, "Oh, you need to write with a twist," was really that discouraging because you didn't want to play the game or because you thought maybe you weren't a great writer?
I didn't want to play the game, but there's a lot. You know, I went to my college reunion recently and I realized, you know, I was an outlier there. I grew up in the suburbs, 50 miles from New York City. That means it's all New York media, New York television, New York radio. It was the 60s. I went to college, 45% of the people were prep school students, and in addition to get into a college of that caliber, you have to do well in school. And I went to college with the grinds. I went to college. I did not go to a large college. When I graduated, the graduating class was in excess of 400 people. I can think of one famous person. She wrote the Vagina Monologues. Other than that, people were financiers, lawyers, what their parents told them to be in the 70s. When I moved to Los Angeles in the mid 70s and ultimately to the state, I found people just like me who went to UCLA. You know, Harold Bronson, who ultimately started Rhino Records with Richard Foose. These people had the same identity, whereas I'm in the middle of Vermont, I'm an outlier.
What did you think you wanted to do in the music business? Or you didn't even know that you wanted to go into the music business? Or where did you think you were going to end up in the industry?
Well, first, I wanted to be a writer. A dream was to write for Rolling Stone. I'm talking about before I stopped writing in 1972. What people don't understand is in the 60s, especially in the 70s also, it was different. You get a lot of people lying about their age, saying it's the same as it ever was. It is not. Taylor Swift, which is a dangerous subject since she wrote a song about me, there is mania. There is no level of mania compared to the Beatles. They were inescapable. The example I always give is we all listen to AM radio. The British invasion happened at the beginning of 1964. I can sing every lick of Hello, Dolly and Strangers in the Night, not because I love those records, but I was waiting for the Beatle records. Okay? There is not a soul alive in 1965 who did not hear Satisfaction. They may not have liked it, but it was everywhere. Whereas, go someplace and ask people to name two songs from the new Taylor Swift album. They can't do it. Maybe the people in attendance can. I do this all the time, all different ages. They can't do it. This is not a put down of Taylor Swift. I'm just saying she is seen as the peak. Whereas you go down, Chris Stapleton, BTS, we go, believe me, there's no chance. But we have a media still operating on an old paradigm. And as a result, they're pushing a narrative which is no longer true.
Wait, but what did you think you were going to do in the music industry?
Well,
Or you
okay,
thought
so
you were
the
going to be a
music,
writer?
okay, yeah, thanks for bringing me back. Music drove the culture. And music was everything. Ultimately, in the late 60s, certainly if you were in the metropolis, it switched to FM. It's full service. They had news, they had attitudes, etc. It literally drove everything. Also, you can say there weren't a lot of other things that were diversions. There were no video games. There were no DVDs. However, I view music as number two to sex. I mean, people will drop everything. Sex is the number one, orgasm, the number one experience, but a great record is number two. So music was everything. You listened to what the stars had to say. I wanted to be closer. I had no idea. After I gave up on being a writer, I ultimately went to law school because my father would pay. I never had any intention of practicing law, but my main motivation was to get a job at a record company. At the time, the record companies were run by lawyers. They're not run by lawyers today. And my father was a real estate appraiser, so I had no win. What was the dream at that point, if you ask me? I wanted to be an A&R guy. I wanted to, pick the records. That's a bad path, certainly today, but if you ask me what I was thinking about, that was it.
You've said that, people who go to music school, it's basically a degree to end up in middle management. Do you think the industry was like that back then, or was there more room to climb up the ladder, or was it so undeveloped that nobody knew what was going on?
Okay. You could go up the ladder, you just could not get a job. Tower Records on Sunset. You couldn't get a job there. You had to know somebody. You had to be a musician. You couldn't walk in and get a job. You couldn't walk in and get a job at many record stores, which would sound amazing to a kid today. Yes, if you did get a job at a label, there was, and you were good, you could move your way up. Today, it's people making seven figures and all these underlings. In addition, in the 60s and 70s, if you were a successful musician, you were as rich as anybody in America. Okay? Europe, there's some royalty, let's forget. But in America, if you were a big rock musician and you were number one on a consistent basis, you were as rich as ever, and you were even more powerful. This is what the rock star lifestyle was all about. A, you could destroy the hotel room, and your road manager would then whip off from a roll of hundreds how much it cost to repair it. Okay. Secondly, you could say no. Everything today is reverse. Everybody wants to say yes. The goal is, okay, I'll become a big star. I'll have a perfume. I'll play privates. I'll get involved. Back then, you said no. I don't want to be part of the straight world. I have enough money. You people are sold out. There's a famous story. The Eagles did a benefit for Jerry Brown when he was running for president. And they told him what to do. Hey, don't get on stage. This is our audience. Wait until we tell you. Today, everything's reversed.
Bob, in an industry that is so small, how have you made it as far as you've made it, being so brutally honest?
Because I used to say I'm the only one. I was listening to Howard Stern earlier in the week, and he was complaining that he put all these years into radio. He got a commercial license. And now anybody can be a radio broadcaster. You know, he was saying he got Kamala Harris for an interview, but so did the woman from
Alex
Call Her
Cooper.
Daddy. Okay. So, yeah, when I started my newsletter, I was the only person doing what I was doing. And it came out every 2 weeks. And it was, you know, if you read me on a regular basis, now I'm covering a million topics and they're all non-analysis. But at that time, it was all business analysis. The interesting thing is, I started the newsletter to get another job in the music business. Only the most successful people subscribed, the heads of all the labels, because they could hear a contrary opinion. Whereas the people further down the roster at the label, they had, you know, drunk the Kool-Aid. To this day, I was talking to a guy who ran one of the major label groups, and he was talking to a new head of promotion at a label, and the guy was saying, "Oh, radio and this and that." Now, you're in Nashville. Country radio is a little bit different. Let's just talk regular pop, top 40 radio. You know, radio is everything. It's not. You know, people get invested in their job such that they can't see another perspective. That's one of the reasons Irving Azoff is so successful. He has a sense of humor about himself. He can acknowledge some of the negative stuff. Doesn't mean that he doesn't fight back. And in addition, he's brilliant and a seer. But he's like a regular person. I'll talk to these very successful promoters and they'll talk about a tour they're behind. They want to convince you that the act is changing the world. Listen, you made a lot of money. A lot of people went. That's great. But it's not really impacting the culture at large. Can we talk about something else? Having said that, if you're, you know, live drives a culture at this point. If you're backstage, no one wants to talk music anymore. They want to talk streaming television or politics. And that's a reference to what I was saying earlier. Music is not in a good spot. We argued for Nexus for a decade about distribution in the music business. It has been figured out. There is nothing beyond Spotify because Spotify is on demand. They deliver it when you want it. There is nothing beyond that. Okay. As the years go by, fewer people are complaining because they're not caught up in the game of yore. When it was very difficult to get a deal, but if you got a deal, the record label kept you alive. I want to go one step further. I know the musicians from this era. I won't say all of them, but a very healthy percentage of them, far in excess of 50%, who you know the names of, never got a single royalty check. Limp Bizkit just sued Universal. They didn't get paid. And everybody's saying, oh, Spotify doesn't pay that well. Well, in the old days, you wouldn't have had a deal at all. Now you can make the record on your laptop. You can distribute it at a de minimis price, CD Baby, a million. It's on all the streaming services. You say, why aren't I rich? Well, in the old days, you wouldn't even be able to play. And even if you did play, you'd be broke. This woman, Libby Titus, in her last chapter, was married to Donald Fagen. She co-wrote a standard, Love Has No Pride. She was selling, you know, fur at Bendel's in New York. You know, the reverse side of this, if you write an iconic track that is licensed, you can live off that one song. Let's be clear, the money has always been in the song. So you're catching me on a day when I'm a little below the weather or whatever, and I can't remember exactly how I was circling back to all that,
Here
so I'll
was
let you bring me back.
the question. The question is, now you're Bob Lefsetz, but when you were starting out, why did you have the confidence to be able to go against the grain and to be so honest in such a small industry?
A, that's who I am. That's who my father is. One of the weird things about growing older, the older you get, you ultimately realize how similar you are to your parents. My father made a good live. Okay, normally a real estate appraiser is a schlepper. For those who don't know Yiddish, that's a guy in a bad sport coat shows up, really, you know, forget about him. My father came from nothing. He was an engineer. He lost his job and he said, fuck, I'm never going to do this again. So he owned a liquor store. Then he turned that into another liquor store. Believe me, this is not a chain. I went back for the unveiling of my mother's headstone a year ago in Connecticut. I took my girlfriend by the liquor store. She couldn't believe it. They don't even make stores that small anymore, literally. But in the late 60s, a friend he grew up with, this is in Bridgeport, Connecticut, said, "Hey, they're going to do all this redevelopment here. And if no one knows more about the local real estate." My father was in commercial real estate on a very low level because he didn't have any money, but he knew the landscape. Said, "If you become an appraiser, I will hire you on all my cases." It's a little off point, but maybe it isn't. So the way it works is there's condemnation. A state wants to build a highway. They say, "We're going to build the highway through your house." So they have their own appraiser say, "Well, your house is worth $100,000." Well, maybe you think that's what it is, and you take the 100K. Or else you say, "I think I'm getting ripped off." And they go to their lawyer. The lawyer would call my father, said, "Morris, go take a look." My father might go out there and say, "100K is a good, this happened, 100K is a good price." But he might say, "Hey, they're ripping you off." Ultimately, there would be a hearing, which other people would be trials. And I went with him a few times. He was brutally honest. In addition, if you're in the metropolis, every lawyer, every doctor is a specialist, but they're general practitioners when you live in the suburbs, at least when I was growing up. My father did this every day. So, the lawyer, they would do multiple things. So my father would literally write a script, and people can't understand in the cell phone day. Every night the phone used to ring, and my father used to yell at these people. "Shut up! Just do what I'm telling." And he made so much money for people. He could only get a flat fee. Under the law, you can't get a percentage, that they continued to hire him. In addition, my mother was a very social person. As they said about Reggie Jackson, she was the straw that stirred the drink. So there'd be a lot of events at my house. And my father would, you cook on the barbecue, he would make the drinks. And these people would be bullshitting, even my mother. And at some point, he would flip out and say, "That's completely untrue." So all these years later, I see that as my identity. I'll go one step further because I've thought a lot about this. I went to college. There was not a single objective test. Every test was an essay test. First semester, first year, I took an anthropology course. The teacher said, "We're never going to discuss the reading in class. If you can't read, you shouldn't be here to begin with." So I went to college. They taught us the power of analysis. People are not going to like this, but the music business is a dumb business. Used to run really on intimidation, with guns and attitude and bullying. That's still there, but a lot has been squeezed out. Live Nation is a public company. The three major labels are public companies or part of a public company. So I knew how to see the issues. The average person couldn't. So if you go back to your initial question about school, music business school, they can teach you about royalties, they can teach you the mechanics. Everybody. To a person who's been successful in the music business is an entrepreneur who would be successful at whatever they did. Look at David Geffen. He started out in the movies and then switched to music with Laura Nyro, and the rest is history. Then he had Broadway, did all these other things. Irving Azoff, all these people. Chris Blackwell. These people, you can't educate people like this. They have the identity or they don't. And what you have to realize, there's a great line from Bob Dylan on the album John Wesley Harding, where it's called "Dear Landlord." He goes, "Each of us has his own special gift, and you know that was meant to be true. And if you don't underestimate me, I won't underestimate you." This is going to sound like boasting, but I could know more of the powerful players in the music business than literally anybody else. Okay. And this is a business built on relationships. I never, ever work those relationships. It
What
drives the people. I'm not calling somebody for something for two reasons. One, this is a business of favors. And you ask a favor, they're going to ask a favor down the line, and you just have to do it. I mean, I'll give a very minor example, and this was very important to me. I had a friend whose buddy that he grew up with was a big movie director. And another friend of mine was kind of lost in life. And I said, well, can my friend lost in life go hang out on the set of your friend, the movie director? Sure, he put it together. About 6 months later, this guy, the label he was working for was merged to something else. And he says, you got to call this other label, these people are your friends, and you got to tell them I want that job. Well, a couple of things here. Yes, I knew the people, the other label, and I knew they didn't even want to hire him. It had come up a conversation for some reason. But I had to call him again. And these were all friends. So this is a business where, I mean, if you say something, everybody who's written an expose about the music business can no longer work in it. Hitman, the most legendary book. The guy's never even done anything of any note after that. You burn your relationships. There's a code, and there's certain things that you just cannot say. You can say them. You can say them once. But therefore, when I was talking about relationships, is that I don't work the relationships, which is what everybody else does. But I can write this shit. What I'm telling people here, do not try to squeeze yourself into a role that you do not fit in or that you're not the absolute best in. I can tell you about jobs. I know people who are PR people. Forget the ones who are full of shit, but I know good ones. They can talk to people. I can't do that. There's all kinds of things I can't do. I can do this one thing. You have to find out the one thing you can do. In addition, this is a business. I mean, look at all the labels. I know this woman who teaches at Harvard, and she places her students in entertainment companies. Never in the labels because there's no upward mobility because the skills don't translate. Yeah, you work in the movie business, finance, but that's not the music business. Even at this late date, it's a freewheeling business. And we're seeing this as, we've had consolidation, there are three major label groups, but they're leaking market share and power every day. Today, it's never been more about the independents. In addition, it's more about touring than the records. Forget the finances involved. Used to be there was a whole club circuit that was kept alive by the major labels. Their acts would go on the road, they would buy tickets. Most of these. They'll call me and they'll say, do you want to go to this show? Let me tell you, I could tell you these are household name acts, okay? I said, sure. Then they'll call me again. We're putting the buy-in. We only have eight tickets. This isn't an arena. I could call the guy who's the actual promoter, whether I want to go or not, but I'm crying. They don't buy tickets to anything. They don't have the money.
The
In
labels.
addition,
You're talking about the labels.
yes. In
Yes.
addition, people don't understand the touring business whatsoever.
Wait, hold on. Can we back up for a second? For one
I
second.
will just one
Oh,
second to make this
okay.
point. The record labels put up less money than ever before, and they keep all the money. These are, of course, general statements. The promoter puts up all the money, and if the date goes clean, they make less than 5%. They're keeping the acts alive. Okay, what's your question?
Okay, wait, going back, you just said it. You said that nobody's written about the music industry and really been able to work around it or hang around it, but you write about the music industry every day, and sometimes you're brutally honest. How have you stayed in it? Is it because you're independent and nobody can shut you down?
Let me just go. At this point, I've told these stories again and again, but maybe it's a different audience. You have to be willing to starve. I don't have any real estate. I don't have any kids. Things are good now, but the 90s were very bleak. Okay, so yeah, this was the most important thing to me. I know a lot of people can't believe it. A lot of people, money's the most important thing. It's just not the most important thing to me. I don't want to starve. I want to have enough. But, I was at a charity event earlier in the week, and there are people listening to this podcast would know, oh, a watch, $100,000. They're only spending $100,000 because they have it. I'm going to go one step further. In the 80s, we had the CD. Production was an issue. Even getting the space to get your CD produced, which is sort of amazing if you think about all the AOL discs that ultimately came out. And to start a new technology, they told the Yaks, take half the royalty. We're doubling the retail and we're giving you the same royalty. And when things are good, we're going to raise the royalty. They never did that. There was so much money generated that suddenly in the 90s, the executives were making more money in the than the acts, which was not the case in the 70s, in the late 60s. So the executives saw themselves as the stars. Tommy Mottola, I could go on and on. In addition, in the 80s with MTV, you could suddenly be a star around the world. There was not this vehicle previously. So if you were on MTV, and not everybody was, and you sold these overpriced CDs, there was so much money. This is the paradigm that is squeezing the major labels to begin with. You know, if you look back in the 60s, I was reading some, I think it was Relics or something, and they were talking about re-releases. No, it was the Wall Street Journal, and they were talking about re-release jazz records from Atlantic Records in the late 60s. I'm not a big jazzer. I knew who these people are. These records cost almost nothing to make, $5,000 to $15,000. That was the business. They didn't say, oh, we're going to put out this record, we're going to sell 4 million copies. Okay. Whereas today, they put out fewer records than ever before. And because of opportunity costs, they want to make sure they're hits. So they have co-writers, they have remix. They want to get to the point. They take the soul right out of the records. An incredible numbers of the most legendary songs you ever heard. The song was written in 10 or 15 minutes, and the record was cut in under an hour in one take. Okay? It maintained that indescribable essence. Look at dock of, sitting on the dock of the bay, okay, Otis Redding. You can hear the fingers on the strings. They would squeeze that out today, okay? But you don't want to get rid of the essence. So the business has completely changed to the detriment of everybody.
Okay, so your friend at Harvard who places people in entertainment jobs but doesn't put them in record labels, what are the jobs today that people should be going into, or what are the best positions today if you're starting out?
Okay, I knew this A&R guy. I said, I'm not going to mention some of these names, you know, because they're much more three-dimensional than the stories I'm telling. And I'm having, he's working for a major label, and he's an A&R guy. He had a senior VP, and we're there talking, and he goes, I got into this business to sign another Beatles. Decades later, never found him. This business is based on talent. We don't need people who know every record. We don't need people who know all the statistics. People would be stunned at the powerful executives who know much less about music than they do. Okay. You need to attach yourself to talent. This is the what the, you know, this is something that you cannot learn in school. You have to be able to find it, sign it, and nurture it. If you have a hit act, I mean, there's this act, this rapper Logic had a really big moment. The guy who was the manager went to college to play soccer. That didn't really work out. He trolled the internet, took the train to Maryland to find this guy, built him into what he was. You know, he was on the Grammys. He was the manager. The doors opened because everybody wanted Logic. He happened to be a good manager. But you could be a better manager. Doesn't make any difference. You don't have the act. So if you want to be in this business, attach yourself to talent. In addition, if you're asking my advice, you want to be in the touring business. Money is generated, and you can work in the touring business forever. Up until the last, maybe this century, the labels were very fluid. There were six major label groups, and they would fire the heads all the time and they would reshuffle everybody. That's not the case anymore. So there's not that many opportunities, and it means less and less. But There's that famous joke, about the guy in the circus who's shoveling up the shit from the elephants. Why don't you quit this job and leave show business? If you're not, there's a great line when Jeffrey Katzenberg was number two at Disney, and this is a true story. If you don't come in on Saturday, don't even think about coming in on Sunday. And he would literally go on the weekends. He would put his hands on the hoods of cars to see whether they were still warm or not, as far as to find out whether the person got there just before him because they were worried about Katzenberg not liking, feeling negative about him, or whether they were really dedicated. I hear this from musicians all anymore. How am I going to pay my mortgage? How am I going to pay for my kids' education? Who told you to have a house? Who told you to have kids? I mean, if you're not willing to work round the clock. Having said that, I have a friend who runs an independent label, very successful, and he has a lot of problems with employees because they won't do the things that people used to do. Okay, you got to go pick this person up at the airport. It's 10 o'clock on Friday night. Well, I'm watching TV. If you're willing to do anything, you're going to get ahead, especially in an era where people don't. But if you want to make it to the top is a whole nother. You want to make it, you have to attach yourself to talent. Do not start an independent label. The reason record labels are successful is because of their catalogs, which have already, the cost of that have already been amortized over the decades. So they're streamed on streaming service. That's raw cash, just like the movie studios, the movies from decades past. If the most successful independent studio of all time, Caralco, okay, went out of business because it didn't have a catalog. If you're starting a label as part of a whole giant enterprise, maybe. But if you say, I'm going to start a record label, no. I mean, you could have success, but I could tell you 20 reasons why the odds are stacked against you. Whereas, if you have an act that people want to see, the money is right there. They play a bar, they get paid $250. Probably you're starting off, you're not going to commission them. But if they're good, word spreads. This is what people don't like. They don't like that in today's world, you cannot game the system. Radio, I could talk about country radio. It's a different animal, but top 40 radio, it was a controlled market. And if you got on there, you had a leg up. Today, no one has a leg up. What happens on radio is radio reacts to Spotify. Listen, there are other streaming services. It's a Spotify world. I mean, people are so dumb. Yeah, I'm going to make
Why
people
are they
mad at
dumb,
me.
Bob? Why are they dumb?
People will email me. I'll get to the end and explain it. Apple Music pays more per stream than Spotify. It is not a per stream calculation. They just put it in that number so you can understand. There's a giant pool of money, and then they distribute it based on the number of listens. I'm not making this up. This is all statistic. People are less active listeners on Apple. Therefore, since there are fewer people streaming the songs, each stream is worth a little more. Whereas the people on Spotify are streaming much more actively. Therefore, the payment goes down. So, what do you want? You want fewer people to listen to you, or you want more people to listen to you? I mean, this is Tech 101. Monetization comes last. Okay. And Spotify rules the world. Everyone said it was going to be eclipsed by Apple, just like people said, if you know your internet history, that AOL was going to be eclipsed by MSN. Maybe at this date, neither is important. Apple is the, I mean, Spotify is the standard. I could go deep into all these details. Oh, does it sound the best? This, forget it. The most people. Literally, the most people and the most active listeners are on Spotify. And just one other thing that, people will tell you this is a business of lying. Someone tells you they sold 100,000 independent records, maybe they sold 1,100. Okay. People will find a chart anywhere and tell you they're number one. I'm number one at Klezmer Music in the eastern half of Afghanistan. Who gives a shit? People tell you that where they are on the chart on the iTunes store. That's 100% irrelevant. There's almost no market there. In addition, it skews old. Who the hell is going to buy a file? Okay, so how do you get action on Spotify? The most active listeners do not listen to these generated playlists. Say, oh, I want to get on the playlist. Well, you get on the play. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but that is, I can tell you people who made some serious dough by being on a playlist. That's the only paycheck they ever got because no one cared about their music in general. How can you generate heat so people find you? Then there are acts that do incredible business and their streaming numbers are not gigantic, like Tedeschi Trucks. I could name now more than ever all these acts on the road doing great and the streaming isn't gigantic. There are multiple pieces of the puzzle. Just to go a couple of steps further, if you are complaining about today's game, you don't understand the old game. You're delusional. As I said earlier, chances are you wouldn't even be able to get a deal. You wouldn't even be able to play. But you're complaining in a world where you can make the record for free on your laptop, distribute it for almost nothing, and promote it for free all over the internet. And this is a problem. What people don't realize is we are, okay, there's this woman, Mitsuka Ichida. She is the Mozart expert. Okay, she's a pianist. And I read this article where she said, I tell my students to practice really hard and do their best to be great because there's very little great in the world. And if you're great, people will find you. That's 100% true. It's like people say, fly across the world, speak at my conference, it'd be good publicity, you know? If you pay me, you know, pay me enough and put me in the front of the plane, I'll go. But say, no, you're going to do it for free. It's good. What are you nuts? If I sit at home in my house and I write something phenomenal, I'll reach a zillion more people. Listen, you know, I have this experience. If you write something phenomenal, very insightful, the reach is unbelievable. How many times can I write an 11? If I can write an 11 once or twice a month, that's unbelievable. I've been doing it so long, I'm never going to write anything below a 7. And it frustrates me. And the other thing, I just go back and write things again. You have to have a steady stream of product. In the old days, a stiff would hurt you. Remember when Justin Bieber was putting a record out every month or every week? Nothing happened. Then he put out that one, you know, that album, you know, with all the hits. Didn't matter. So if it's not that good, it's going to be forgotten. The other thing is stop bugging me to listen to it. People, I believe in starting at the top. You want to deal with the person who can say yes or no. Otherwise, get out of the way. Okay? I want to talk to the head of the company. You want it or you don't want it? You don't want it? That's fine. I don't want to spend all the time with the person who says, well, you know, I love it. We got to go. We got to talk to the president. Having said that, what people don't understand is when you're starting out, your friends and your contacts are the other people starting out, not the people at the top. You leverage all those relationships and you go together. If you try to jump the ladder unnecessarily, the doors are going to be closed. What I said once before, if you happen to have hit talent, the doors open instantly. But if you don't,
Okay, wait, to put a bun on an earlier question, what roles do you attach yourself to talent besides being a manager and being an agent? Is that are those the two roles? Is there any other role where you should be attaching
oh,
yourself
wait,
to
wait, wait.
talent?
Do not be a manager. Being a manager is a license to starve.
Okay, what should you be?
Okay, well, let me just tell you. So, if you have an act that generates talent, or are an entrepreneurial person who can work for a larger firm to the point that you can sign your own talent and have it grow with that firm or independently, that's one thing. Okay. Promoter. You want to work for the promoter. You could even start working at the building. You just want to get started such that you interact with other people. As I said earlier, it is all about relationships. The other thing is the number one criterion is you have to be able to get along. It's just like being an act. No one wants to sign an asshole. They don't care how talented they are. They want to know that they can hang with you. I mean, the touring business is unbelievable. You know, There'll be bands talking about promoters that are friends. They only see them once every other year. This just blew my mind. But then you also realize they live an itinerant lifestyle. These are really their friends. So if you're working in a building and every time the promoter comes through, you're hanging out, you're a good guy. Well, maybe there'll be an opportunity there. Okay. As far as an agent, there's different levels. You can be working in your neighborhood, about hit. These are If you're an entrepreneur, you're gonna find your way no matter what. I'll tell you two stories. I started law school, and the very first day, there's some kind of orientation, and the fucking HR person, or whatever they call them, the career counselor says, "If you're, and I'm in Los Angeles, if you're here to get in the entertainment business, drop out right away." Let me be clear. I had the world's worst case of mononucleosis. I didn't want to be there to begin with, and I said, "Well, maybe I should drop out." What I found was everybody else didn't need it as much as I did. This is a very hard business to stay in. I have all these friends who we used to, hang out 20 years ago. They haven't been able to work in the music business for in excess of a decade. Okay? So you have to really need it. You have to be willing to sacrifice, and you have to be willing to work 24/7. How many people does that include? Almost no one. They're not lining up to be garbage men. It's an honest job, sometimes a union, and it's not that easy to get. People are lining up to work for free in the entertainment business. And a lot of cliches are true. You get a good job, you're making multiple six figures, you buy a house, you have kids, and then they fire you because they want someone cheaper who's available 24/7. You want to go to the kids' soccer game. You want to go on family vacation? Fuck you. We want somebody we own. This is the way it works. If you're working in this business and you're not available on Saturday and Sunday, I know these people who don't answer their email on Saturday and Sunday. And on my particular world, I'm inundated and sometimes I just need to chill out. Believe me, something important comes over my transom. I know people will send you an away message. Oh, it's the weekend. I don't respond. Or you're emailing about something, you don't hear back from Monday. You're never gonna make it. So you have to find your, if you talk to everybody in this business of my vintage, a little bit younger, it all kind of happened by accident. There used to be this Columbia, CBS Records, a lot of people, they worked in record stores. They got it to know the people who came in the record store, and they gave them a job in the warehouse, the branch warehouse, or else they said, "Oh, you can be part of the college program, or you can do this." It wasn't like they were sitting there planning out their future. They fell in. Having said that, music is a very mature business to its detriment. Those old enough to have lived through the 90s and even the first decade of the century knew when the internet was just fucking wild. There was a new company, you needed a new computer every week, blah, blah. That it's a mature business now. So if you want to be an independent concert promoter, I know a couple of people who've done it by booking things the majors don't make, but that's, Live Nation's a public company. They can take the hit. They can lose six figures on the gig. You can't, and you can't even book the big talent. Not to mention, in fact, the agents, if you're an independent person, they make a more heinous deal because they want to see if you can survive. Okay? So if you're sitting, the systems are more regularized than ever before. Having said that, there's always a demand for hits. Completing the thought I made earlier on this foggy day, in my mind anyway. So we spent 10 or 15 years debating distribution. It's been figured out. It's streaming. Now the focus is on software, i.e., the songs. The distribution is there. Can you create a song that I like so much I want to tell people about it? I just wrote something about Billy Squier. I didn't know Billy Squier personally. I know his story. Somebody sent me one track, and I said, "Wow, this is pretty good." So I'm telling other people about it. You know how much shit comes across my transom? I don't write about almost anything. Also, I had this friend who was a legendary attorney, was Stevie Wonder's attorney. I'm at lunch one day, and he goes, "I'm not a railroad train. I don't pick people up at one station and drop them off at another. Don't ask for favors that you don't deserve. You have to create your own openings.
Okay, Bob, last time we were together, you asked me if I wanted money or power in life, and you said that you can't have both. Why can't you have both?
Well, everything's relative. Let me be very clear. The people with the most, okay. Biden stepped down from running for president. They actually have a new story in the New York Magazine about modern media, et cetera. I don't agree with everything they say, but they make this point, which I 100% agree with. Biden stepped down because of what was written in the New York Times. If you look at the financials of the New York Times, they're terrible. They make a profit. This is not billions. Maybe if they sold the paper, but even the paper's not worth that much. But they have an incredible amount of power. Okay? So there are certain, if you are an artist, and I use this example. At this point, it's almost 15 years ago. Jay-Z made a deal with Samsung for an exclusive track with, I think it was an exclusive album. What difference does it make? With Samsung during the NBA playoffs. He got paid seven figures. He said, oh, big victory. At the time, because I knew people involved, they had a budget more than a far in excess of 100 times what they paid Jay-Z. But Jay-Z had incredible power. He could say, I hate Samsung. Look at Kid Rock, what he did to Bud Light. Okay. I'm not saying that Kid Rock doesn't have money, but there are other people. That's power. Do you want to change? The other thing is power. You have the right to say no. Okay. There are certain people, they don't say, well, you don't have as much money as I have. Therefore, no, I have the power. I can say yes. I can say no. So there are many jobs that you can work in your community that are well paying, and maybe you even have a little power in your community. But when the act comes to town and you can't call the agent and say, give me a front row seat, even I'm limited, you don't have any power in that world. So, and look at politicians. Most of them are not extremely wealthy. They have a lot of power.
Okay, I'm going to name a couple modern acts that you write about pretty frequently. I'd love to know what you think they're doing right or what you think they're doing wrong, or just anything else that comes to mind when I say their names. Okay, you write about Zach Bryan. What should the big takeaways be with Zach Bryan?
Well, Zach Bryan has stepped in a little bit recently with a couple of tweets and the breakup of the girlfriend, but before that, it was all positive. He is selling authenticity and credibility. You have to go before he worked with, it was a Casey Musgraves and had a hit. The songs were songs that you could sing to and relate to. They were not about production. Word spread amongst the active consumer, the late teens and the early 20-somethings, such that, they invited me to the gig. This is at the Wiltern. Now he plays stadiums. Everybody knew every song. In addition, he also can say no to things. He named an album where he's sticking up to Ticketmaster. I could get, I could, I won't say he's 100% accurate, but the fact that he was willing to make that statement makes him successful and powerful.
Okay, what do you think about Sabrina Carpenter and her latest album?
Who cares?
Okay, fair enough. Okay, what about
No, and I
Oasis?
mean,
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'll go a little bit deeper.
Go a little deeper, Bob.
She's a known name. She was on the Disney Channel. She worked with the hit maker du jour, what, Dan Nigro, I believe his name is. She opened for Taylor Swift. They concocted a song. I mean, this whole horse shit about the Song of the Summer, not to mention the fact we don't even listen to all the same songs. She had a hit. And in today's world, what people don't understand is today there's 100 million more people than there were in America in the 70s. There's, an audience for everything. So she went on the road. Talk to me 10 years from now whether she can sell out these deans. It's not changing anybody's life. That's what I'm into.
Okay, and what about Oasis and the reunion?
What people in America don't understand is what Oasis represents in the UK. Working class people who are the antithesis of those in control. There's a whole cultural element to Oasis that people in America just do not understand. Okay. That's why it's such a big deal in the UK. The fact that the stadium dates went clean in America, I would not have predicted that. They obviously sold from Mania, and this also happened in the UK. People didn't want to be left out. I was happened to be in the UK and somebody's waiting on us. And they find out I'm in the music business. Can you get me tickets to Oasis? Are you a big Oasis fan? No, but I want to go. Okay. I saw Oasis at the Whiskey. They already had an album out in the UK. The album after that had just been released. I saw them open for the Black Crowes at the Greek. Not to mention, I seen both brothers individually. I like Champagne Supernova. The fact that it's such a big deal is in America is surprising to me. As far as the ticketing, what people don't know is it's a very fluid business. These acts go on the road every other year. In the case of Oasis, not in excess of a decade. And a lot of times the manager, usually it's the lawyer and people in the business who are working every day who understand the concept. These two fucking Gallagher brothers. Okay, let me give you some insight. In the UK, the whole issue of scalpers and paying more, that doesn't exist. So therefore, that's to a great degree why the dynamic pricing was such a big thing. In America, it is well known by everybody in the business. If you don't flex the price, the scalpers are going to get the tickets. Okay, look at some famous things. We have, suddenly I can't remember his name. It'll come back to me. The biggest guy in country music, who
Morgan
Garth
Wallen
Brooks.
or Garth Brooks.
Garth Brooks goes on tour, charges a low price, plays until demand expires. There's no scalping. Because as long as people want to go, he's playing. There's no scalping for Stones tickets. They charge what they're worth, and the act gets all the money. I got a personal bug up my ass about this for numerous reasons. One, you're saying Springsteen is charging more than $100. Okay, this was the big kerfuffle a couple of years ago. Okay, this is a baby boomer, maybe Gen X audience. You're going for dinner. Either the night before or the night of the gig, each person is in excess of $100, but you won't pay $100 for Bruce. And then also, you think because you listen to the records a lot, you're entitled to sit down close for cheap. What fucking world are you living in? You don't go to the Mercedes-Benz dealer and say, I love to drive. Sell me the car for 15K.
Okay, Bob, we're running out of time here. I want to ask you a couple little other questions. First of all, New York Times are now putting their podcasts behind a paywall. Their most recent episodes they're going to give for free or keep free, but the rest of the podcasts are going to be behind a paywall. Is that a crazy idea or does that make sense?
You got a lot of things going on here. Let's go back. I used to charge for my newsletter. I make a lot more money giving it away for free. My reach is this. This is me personally. The New York Times is running a business. And they had this guy, Mark Thompson, an Englishman, who came up with this concept of subscribers. Now, they have a soft paywall that you can read. I think at the last, it's either 8 or 10 articles a month for free. I'm not exactly sure because I've been a subscriber forever. And so the casual user can participate, just like with some of these podcasts. But for years, the New York Times was free online. But then when print and print advertising went down, they had to make the money somehow. The New York Times can get away with this. They have 10 million subscribers, not all to print. There's cooking, there's games. Can other people? I mean, it cracks me up when you have these local newspapers behind paywall. I can't read the story. As I say, it comes down to economics in every situation. I do not think that's a bad idea for the Times, no.
Okay,
But
fair enough.
let's stay there. Let's
Stay
stay
here.
there. Because Joe Rogan was exclusive to Spotify, and Spotify changed that and say he can be on all the services. So generally speaking, distribution is king and you want to be available everywhere, but every situation is not identical.
Wait, so is it not a bad idea for the Times because they have the audience, and on top of that, they also need to make money, and this is a path to money. That's why it's an okay idea.
Well, the kind of, a lot of podcasts like we're doing here, they don't cost that much. They do a lot that are have high priced. Advertising is not that big. So how do they pay for it? Okay. Other people just keep slashing what they have. Well, we won't have podcasts at all. So is it a choice? If it's a choice between having a podcast division or not having one, sure, put it behind a paywall.
Okay, fair enough. Bob, we are running out of time. Really quickly, you sometimes talk about how skiing used to be a immature business, now it's a mature business, and you sometimes relate that to the music industry. Where has skiing become too mature, and how does that affect the sport?
Okay, I trying to think how to tell the story of mature and immature. Skiing was a middle class sport, but we also lived in a middle class society. Reagan legitimized greed. The baby boomers took that ring and ran with it. So the middle class has been hollowed out. Skiing had a stagnant number of people who were skiing. There became an arms race. This is very similar to what you're talking about with the New York Times. High speed lifts, which changed the game. In case you're not a skier, they run 2.5 times faster than conventional lifts. In many cases, they've completely eliminated lines, okay? But they're very expensive. So they had to raise the ticket price in order to pay for that. Then you have this guy, Rob Katz, and he's running something originally called Vail Associates, bought by Apollo, which is a big Wall Street firm. He decides to reverse the game. What happened was there was a roll-up in the 90s, something called the American Ski Corporation that went bankrupt. They thought the game was real estate, added to this company, Intrawest. Rob Katz said, "That's not what we're going to do. There's a million reasons why that doesn't work. We're going to get people to the hill. We're going to make money on lessons. We're going to make money on rentals. We're going to make money on food. And if you've been to Vail and all these other places, you see the Salomon store, the Patagonia store. They're actually owned by Vail. Let's be clear. You can go, you can bring your own food and ski for cheap. To make it work, you had to have a huge audience." And what they did was they lowered the price to incentivize. In addition, it's a very cyclical business. And if you can get all the revenue prior to the season beginning, if it's a bad snow year, you're not crippled. In addition, they have outlets all over the world at this point. The problem is they have not figured out a way to make new skiers. Okay, skiers has gone through the roof. The business is very healthy. And I would say the main issue is perception. Everyone says skiing's too expensive. Skiing's too expensive. When in reality, almost every ski area has a program where if you're a newbie, for a relatively low price, they'll get you on the hill. And as far as buying a ticket at the gate, that's just like there are people who walk up to American Airlines, "I'm going to Hawaii today, quote me a price." People learn not to do that. And every year there's a new cycle. But the main problem with skiing is perception. It's been seen as an elite thing. If we analogize it to the music business, we have concert tickets. They are only charging this price because of the demand. If no one wanted to go, the gig wouldn't happen or the price would be very cheap. Okay? Right now, the cheapest World Series ticket's $1,000, and people are running to pay them. Those even aren't good seats. But somehow people decide music should be cheaper. Why? Okay? And the acts are afraid to charge what the tickets are worth, so the scalpers get the uplift. This is a perception issue. As far as Spotify goes, that is also a perception issue. The average person not in this industry believes that Spotify rips off musicians. Nothing could be further from the truth. If we go back to an internet company, it's scale. This is why the record business works so well. It took $50,000 to make the record, okay? If the record stiff, you were out $50,000 plus the marketing costs. But if the record was successful and you sold millions, the cost of record million or 5 million was almost nothing. And today it's even better because you don't have production and shipping. It's all streaming. So Spotify doesn't scale. Whether they have one subscriber or a billion subscribers, they still have to pay approximately 70% to rights holders. They're not ripping off the rights holders. The publishers did not get a fair share, primarily because the labels making the deal with Spotify also own publishers and they screwed their own publishers, but they don't care that they're making it in the long run. If you are not getting paid on streaming, either you have a lousy deal, and a lot of the deals from the last century are lousy, or no one is listening. I get email all the time from acts that you've never heard of who are making a living on streaming because they essentially get all the money and enough people listen. They'd be, well, 1,000 people listen and didn't make any money. I could tell you about people who have 10 million listens and are not making that much money. And my point is, in the old days, you wouldn't even be in the game. I mean, wake up and get in the fucking game. This would be like walking in with your iPhone 3GS and complaining that it's not 5G and I can't do this. And it's like, you gotta buy a new device. This is the world we're living in.
Okay, wait. So how can is the problem with skiing, is that a marketing problem, or how can the sport change the narrative around that?
I believe it's a perception problem. So the key is, how do you get people to the hill and get them hooked on the sport? There's a lot of statistics about this. Not everybody does get hooked up, but most people say, that's not for me. That's a rich man's sport, which a lot of rich people ski, but it really doesn't have to be. Not to mention the fact there are a lot of independent ski areas that don't charge that much ticket, but everyone says, okay, look at the day rate at Vail. It's $295. You can get the entire season at dozens of ski areas for less than $1,000. Just buy it in advance. It's like anything. It's like you want to walk up and buy the ticket, if at the airline counter, that's what's going on. The problem with skiing is they're fighting different wars. Also, Vail. Okay, I go to Vail on a regular basis. They're famous for the back bowls. Originally, the original back bowls, at this point, there's like seven of them, but there were the original two back bowls had a double chair. They replaced it with a triple chair. Then, about 20 years ago, they wanted to replace it with a high speed lift. The locals went berserk. You can't do that. The powder will be eaten up too fast. We see this every ski area. Don't change. They put in the lift. It made things much better. You see all these lines, whatever. Oh, I'll go there for a second. Then they said, oh, we're going to put another lift to get rid of the line. No, don't do that. People do not like change. They think they own the mountain, just like the fans of Springsteen. So you'll see these famous, it's always Vail. You'll see these lines at the gondola, okay? That is the line on a powder day before the lift opens. This is the skier's choice. Lift opens at 8:30. People get out there at 6:30. Okay? Vail didn't make them do it. In addition, the lines in the back bowl were so big, they put in another high-speed lift. But everyone would say, oh, look at that. Look at that thing there. It's all terrible. We're dealing with this right now. By the time this comes out, we have a what's his name? Trump talking to somebody who says, oh, yeah, my electric bill, I think, was $30,000. It's not going to be. Turns out there was a mistake. But the correction doesn't follow up. People like the story. They like to beat, this is the same on everything. Bring manufacturing back to America. Fine. Your flat screen TV will cost $2,000. No. Bring Main Street back. Okay, you go to your bookstore. You got to drive there. You got to pay retail. Well, yeah, it's great, but I'll just order on Amazon. People talk out of both sides of their mouth. It's really incredible. Okay, Amazon's too big. Walmart's too big. If you think not shopping there, you got to start at the top and work down. You got to understand when your voice has credit, when you're actually, people are on the same page as you. This is a land of misinformation. The only good thing is people like to argue. This goes back to Napster. At least people were stealing the music. There's a lot of products people don't even want for free. Okay? The people arguing about skiing things, they want to go. As I say, we have a big problem with the people who don't want to go. But the 60s were a different era of middle class on so many ways. Listen, even I'm flipped out. When I started in my life, a pastrami sandwich was 95 cents. I went to Langer's, which supposedly has the best pastrami sandwich in America, $23.95. Now they can explain the whole prices. All I'm trying to say is, man, that looks bad. Okay. I hear it for people. Also, the rich are getting richer and the poor are not. And I understand why they want to give the middle finger. The problem is we have no leaders. You ask me why I'm successful, I'm speaking the truth. Everybody else has an investment in their own agenda. During Napster, I was talking to the head of one label, and he said, "This has got to be worked out. It's got to be worked out. Otherwise, what am I going to do?" He was worried about his own thing first and foremost. Okay. The other thing is, this is a business of illusion and smoke and mirrors. Do not believe, I'm just going to go one step further on this. There was a household name band that was playing multiple arena dates, and they kept on adding arena dates. So people said, there's an incredible demand. They're all sold out. Therefore, I'm going to buy some tickets to scalp. Well, the real story is none of the gigs were sold out. Okay? People don't understand this is a professional business. Just going back to, we can make it so prices are low. We're going to tie the ticket to you. Let me be clear. Nothing works 100% because you will find scalpers will buy four tickets. They'll have an employee walk in, usher three people in, and leave themselves. You're never going to get 100% of that. But people don't want that because they want to scalp their own tickets. And they'd be convinced by the scalpers, this is the way. So they don't even want the solution. Just let me in the front row. Let me sit there for, I'm a huge fan. So everybody on the inside of it, you think that people on the inside of the business are listening to this and are worried about this? Not in a million fucking years. Ticketmaster's paid to get the heat, take the heat. Do acts worry about prices being too high and people, not liking that? Sure. But they understand how the business works. One of my favorite stories, This American Life did a story on automobile sales. And I have a nephew who's a very successful automobile salesman, and I didn't know this. In order to make money every month, they have to sell the number of cars that the manufacturer says they have to sell. In this case, it was a Dodge dealership. The number, somewhere between 75 and 125 cars a month. If they sold 74, they were not going to get the rebate from the manufacturer, and they were going to lose, the dealership was going to lose close to $100,000. Where if they sold one more car, they were going to get all this money. And literally at the end of the month, they would call relatives. Now is the time to get a car. Okay. That's how the business works. Everybody thinks they're an expert on entertainment. They don't understand this is a professional business. There's all these little nuances. And what people think is, well, I'll go to music business school and I'll learn the nuances. Well, generally speaking, the people in music business school are not the A players. Maybe they have the A players come and speak. But that's not the problem. I hate to go back to law school because law school is a joke. But if they say, we're not teaching you the law because the law changes, we're teaching you how to think about the law. Okay? Do
Right.
I think they in music business school, they give a philosophy? That's not the kind of person who goes. Listen, there are some people who go to the Syracuse School or the Clive Davis School who might be accepted, but it's just like Berklee College of Music. Most of the people you've heard of, like John Mayer, who were successful, they dropped out. They went to Berklee and they said, okay, now I know how good I am. I know the reverse. I know people went to Berklee and say, fuck, I'm not good enough. This is the end of my career. Then you have people say, okay, I was playing in my little burg, I'm good enough. They learn a few tricks from a couple of professors. That's all they need. So it's about the identity of the person. It's not about your degrees. It's not about, all this stuff that you can stack up. It's about wheeling and dealing and being able to close deals. All these soft skills that cannot be taught. You either are this person or you're not. But you are somebody. You can find your role in life, which may not be in the music business.
Bob, I'm wrapping up here. I want to ask you this last question. One of my favorite newsletters that you ever wrote is about you just talking about food at Zabar's, and it's long and it's just great. But when you write a newsletter like that, which has basically nothing to do with the music business, what do you hope your audience takes away from that? You have to be generous enough to think that this is a beneficial thing to be putting out into the world. What do you hope we take away when you write these long newsletters that have nothing to do about the music business
Oh,
and
okay, a couple of
sometimes they have to do
things.
about food.
Those newsletters always get the best response. Always.
Why?
Okay. Because it strikes a note in the heart of people. I was in England about 2 months ago, and we got there really early overnight, and there's some issues in the hotel, and we had to be there. What are we going to do? I wanted to go to some tourist thing, but I've been to England so many times, I've hit most of the places. And my girlfriend says, let's go to Harrods. Okay. We go to Harrods. I walk around. I get a buzz over a couple of things. They have a shoe department there. I've never seen that many models of running shoe. And I have, they sent me Sennheiser, supposedly the best, headphones made, and I saw, things at Harrods for four times the price. So I was inspired. I came home and wrote about it. I was absolutely stunned. My inbox went wild. This is exactly like a great record. I wrote something yesterday. I'm writing it. I go, this is not great. This is an album track. Okay. If you nail it, it could be about anything because we're all human. This is what's wrong with music. It's all formulaic. Everyone says, make a record like your old record. They don't really want that. They want something new. It's like Steve Jobs famously said, I do no market research. Research will tell you where you've been, not where you're going, and what people need. So if I miss the target, if it's not written great, believe me, people go wild on me. So it's inherently a risk, but it's about an experience. I went to this Joni Mitchell Joni Jam over the weekend. The guy in the LA Times wrote a very good review about what happened. That's interesting. That's not what I do. I explain the experience of being there. Just like when these newspapers, it's less of a thing because newspapers are a joke. When they send somebody to review something and they say it's bad, occasionally something is bad. Send someone who's a fan of that band. Don't send a country reviewer to see a metal act. Have someone who's a fan of Slipknot. Was it a good Slipknot show? What was it like? It could be bad, but what is it like if I'm a people? This is what we live for, the experience. We're all lonely. And people identify. I mean, I wrote about babka, which not everyone's even going to know, but you should go online and order some babka. And people, were both reminded of babka, and they all had to order it because they got the idea of the sensuousness of eating something great. So, listening to something great, if I can get the sensu, if I tell you, I mean, this is what cracks me up all over the internet. This is a good record, that's a bad record. Who gives a shit? This is all this writing, you know. That's not what it's about. It's about conveying the essence. If I tell you, okay, good record. If I tell you I was driving down the street, I just had a tooth pulled, I was in a terrible record, my radio was on the fritz, I got it to work, and a record came out, and I turned it so loud the person in the car next to me did it. I got home, I downloaded the track, or I pulled it up my streaming service, I played it 20 times in a row. You're gonna want to play that record. You're gonna say, what the fuck? The other thing is you can't menu. If you play the record, you go, that's terrible. You're never gonna believe me again. So I can't write that about everything. But when I nail it, you say, I know that. I know that experience of having a, but you're talking about Back in Black. I know that experience. It works both when you're in a good mood or a bad mood. I can tell you about playing Back in Black on a boom box in my car with the radio stolen after skiing at Snow Valley on a March day, just loving it. And I can tell you at times I was angry and I cranked it up. We know what's that. This is another thing, going to the gig, it's become a social experience. That's not what it used to be. There was not this festival seating. You paid attention. You didn't shoot selfies. You've revered the music. I'm not saying no one does that. But okay, on the second American Elton John album, which is really the third album, I'll go one step further. Okay, I'm going to say there's a song called Come Down in Time. It is just, it'll blow your mind, just the feeling of it. On the Beach Boys album, Surf's Up, all the word was about that song, Surf's Up, which had been played a number of years earlier on a Leonard Bernstein special on network television. Brian Wilson played it literally in a sandbox. For years, people wrote about it. And the song closed the album. All the hype was about that. In the 90s, 20 years later, Don Was makes a documentary and he focuses on the song before that called Till I Die, which is beyond belief. I mean, it's just, and all of a sudden, say, someone else knows. It took 20 years. We go, the way it affects me is exactly the way it affects me. I felt connected. I felt like the world worked. I didn't get a star. I didn't get a check in my mailbox. Listen, I can tell you about going to see the Stones in 72, dancing in the aisle, and a woman came down. We gave each other looks. That's all that happened. But I can tell you the experience. That's very different. Well, I worked 40 hours. I made $2,000 and I went and bought a very nice coat at Macy's. Well, I hope you enjoy it. It's not the exact same thing.
Bob, you are incredibly effective at this. A couple weeks ago, you wrote about Billy Joel, Miami 2017. I raced to listen to that record after I read what you wrote about it. You always accomplish this. The other thing I want to say in our final moments on the show is you have inspired so many conversations around dinner tables, lunch tables, breakfast tables among people in my family, but also my friends and people in the industry. And you bring people together. That might seem crazy, but you really do because we argue over you. We love you. We fight over you, all the things. And you're a magical, magical presence in my inbox. And I want to thank you so much for taking the time. And I hope we get to do it again.
Absolutely, Zach. See you on the hill.
See you on the hill, Bob. Can't wait.